Hello and welcome to the podcast edition of Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, your source for news, reviews, previews, and interviews with authors and artists about baseball books, music, film, pretty much anything you can fit on a bookshelf. And that's the slogan, if it fits on a bookshelf, it fits here. Dwyer Brown said he had just about the right degree of fame. While he's appeared in dozens of movies and TV shows, he's not in the same category as a Kevin Costner or a James Earl Jones, his co-stars in Field of Dreams. Nevertheless, he's approached by fans who wish to share their thoughts about the impact the iconic closing scene has had on them as they remember their relationships, good and bad, with their own fathers. Brown appeared as John Kinsella, the father of Costner's character Ray. He was only on the screen for about 5 minutes at the end, but for many, those are the most powerful moments of the film, a scene that turned so many men and women into misty-eyed sentimentalists. Brown recently published If You Build It, a book about fathers, fate, and Field of Dreams. It's a memoir that encompasses his experiences with fans as the movie marks its 25th anniversary this year. But it's also the story of his life as a family man, as he recalls his relationship with his own dad. We spoke about all those components in a recent conversation.
Dwyer Brown, welcome to the Baseball Bookshelf.
Hey, thanks, Ron. Good to be here.
Now, you write about your relationship with your father, your acting career, the movie Field of Dreams, and the subsequent encounters you've had with filmgoers. Was any one part more difficult to write than the other?
Actually, I liked writing about my pursuit of being an actor the least. I sometimes kind of feel like those things are like little secrets that actors go through to, and so that was difficult for me to imagine putting out there to readers everywhere. But and I suppose the encounters I've had with fans was the easiest to write. Just because it was, it's been bouncing around in my head for so long, and I was kind of eager to share it with other people.
Now, this movie came out 25 years ago. How soon after it hit the screens did people start coming up to you and recognizing you?
I guess within a few months. It was kind of a new phenomenon, and I was surprised by it for that reason. I guess what was more surprising is when, it continued, and one of the episodes I write about in the book just happened like 3 months ago to me, that really surprises me when people recognize me from that long ago.
And you say that long ago, so people still, I mean, we all age, we all change a little the way we look, but you still have people coming up to you for that?
Yeah, and that's what I find surprising. And it seems to me it's usually when I look the least like I did in the movie. You know, if I haven't shaven for 3 days and, my hair's a wreck and, I'm just slumping around. But I think for the people who that movie touched deeply, my face touched, some of their gray matter in a way that they can piece it together through any disguise I happen to be accidentally wearing.
Now, because of the format of the book, which jumps back and forth between all these elements, I'm having a little trouble keeping the questions in an orderly manner, so please forgive me. What gave you the idea to do the book?
Well, I've always wanted to write a book. My mom was, loves grammar and English, and I just always thought someday I would write a book, and I got to a point where I sort of had some time, and I thought, okay, well, what would I write about? And when I thought about these encounters I've had with fans, I started with that, and then when I started thinking about them and other people's fathers, I began to think of my own and started writing those stories, and it was just like little 5 to 7 page stories I would take to my little writing group every week, and then pretty soon it began to take on a little bit of a shape, but putting them in, intertwining those like 4 storylines was probably the most difficult part of the process.
Did you do it one storyline straight through and then cut it up in the editing process to put it in the order that you did? Or did they cut some individual slices?
Mostly they were little snippets, you know, little, like I said, 5 to 6 page things. Some of those I ended up, splitting up later, but mostly I would write some little story and then realize that, oh, I should follow that through and then write the rest of it or the beginning of it or whatever was missing.
Now, people don't realize, movie fans don't realize, it's a discourtesy in a sense, but actors are people. They have their own lives. So they don't know what the actors are going through at the time of their filming a certain movie. You had recently lost your father before you shot this.
Right. Yeah, I was thinking, selfishly or whatever. I mean, as much as I loved my dad and missed him, but I was thinking, well, this should make me extra emotional for this scene where I'm playing a father who gets a second chance to talk to his son. And what surprised me when I was on the set was that it effectively blocked me from feeling anything at all. I mean, partially because it was so fresh, and I think also because at the time, I just was not ready to deal with my father being gone. I felt his presence around me. I felt it there in Iowa, at the cornfield, which was, appropriate. But it made it difficult for me to kind of, separate my personal life from my artistic life I made my peace with it, fortunately, but it was a struggle for a while.
How far ahead of time? How far before? How long was your father sick?
Well, he wasn't. I didn't know he apparently had been sick for about a month. But as I write in the book, my family is nothing if not polite, and they didn't want to bother me. They figured they would find out what was wrong with him, and then they would tell me what was going on. But it happened that his condition declined suddenly, and then they called me. To come home, and they were sort of still playing it off, but I had this feeling that I should leave immediately. So I changed tickets that I already had for 2 weeks later, and I came home early, and he died that night. So I'm very grateful to have listened to that intuition, and I got a chance to kind of spend his last hours on earth with him, and kind of talk about some things that I'm very grateful to have had the opportunity to talk to him about.
How far ahead of that were you engaged to do Field of Dreams?
I think in May is when I found out that I got the part, and I ended up shooting in July, and my father died in June.
So were your movie mates, your fellow cast members, the crew, were they aware of this, I am imagining?
It's funny when I think back about it, it seemed like I must have been telling people, but I don't think I did, because people that I knew from the movie who've read the book now were quite surprised by it. And I think, again, I was excited about doing the movie. I was excited to be back in the Midwest because my father's presence felt so ripe, particularly there on the farm because I'd grown up on a farm in Ohio. I guess I didn't share that with too many people, and I think it was because I was not ready to mourn that yet. That didn't happen to me for a couple of years before I really was able to realize that that he was gone.
So in all your encounters with fans who come up to you and talk about their relationships with their fathers, whether they were good or bad or indifferent, that must remind you of your relationship with your own father, I imagine.
Yeah, I try to take it that way. It's like a little gift. Every time somebody comes up to me, I try to be very open to them because I think they seek me out in some strange way because they're looking for a little of that redemption that Ray gets in the movie from his father. And so I just try to be very available to them and really listen to them and sort of accept it as if it's my dad coming back and telling me important things about his life that, I fortunately managed to kind of wrestle out of him, in his last few years before he died. And it's been a funny thing. I sometimes equate it to being a priest in a confessional. There's a certain amount of reverence that's required, I think, or at least that I've always felt, because people's, sometimes you get the feeling that the people who come up and talk to me have never said that to anybody else or anybody outside their family. And so I try to be, it feels like it's a respectful little ritual that I'm happy to be a part of.
It seems like it might get to be a burden at times.
Well, it doesn't happen to me all the time. I mean, if I was Kevin Costner and everywhere I went, somebody told me the story about their father, thousands of fans everywhere I went, I think it would probably be burdensome. But because it happens to me with such strange consistency and irregularity, it's to me like the perfect level of fame, because I can lead my life of, picking my kids up at school and eating at restaurants and rarely get recognized. And then every, 3 or 4 months or something, somebody comes up to me, and when they do, it's usually with some, great memory of the movie or, a very touching story about how the movie affected their lives. So it's a great reminder of the power of movies and that, I had this career and at the same time, it's not like, it doesn't keep me from doing, things that, public figures sometimes are relinquished from doing.
In a sense, it's to me, and to a lot of these people who come up to you, you're the star of the movie. Even though you're surrounded by people like Kevin Costner and James Earl Jones and Burt Lancaster, people who've been making movies for decades, and but you are the focal point. The father is the focal point.
Yeah, I was quite surprised by that, because when I auditioned for it and read the script, and even when we were shooting it, it seems like it's a 5-minute part at the end of the movie. It was only at the screening of the film, and I think I attribute a lot of the momentum of my importance in the movie to the soundtrack that James Horner did. There was something about that really built like a locomotive. There's those early chords that are just kind of wispy and vague, and then it really builds to a kind of a thundering storm by the end of the movie, and I think it carried a lot of the emotion. And I always say that, everybody else, James Earl and Kevin and, the director Phil Alden Robinson, they did the hard work of opening the audience's heart, and I just sort of take off my catcher's mask and walk right in. And I'm aware that I think I did a good job with that part, but that movie gets to me every time I watch it. I tear up, and it's me up there on the screen, so I know it's something bigger than me, and I'm just grateful that, I got to have that 5-minute part, but that it kind of took on a larger import with the people who watched it over the years.
Now you're saying that with the benefit of 25 years of retrospection. The first time you saw it, what did you think?
Well, what's interesting is when I think a lot of the cast members would tell you this, cast and crew as well, is that I don't think anybody expected this to be a very big movie. It was such a sweet script and so kind of perfect that I think we all did it for ourselves. It's one of those movies you kind of do because, it gives you a sense of purpose and allows you to do other movies that you make more money and are going to be big blockbusters. So I think many of us were quite surprised when it kind of took off and built the way it did, and certainly that it had this kind of, lasting power. I think, Universal would have bought that farm from the farmer if they'd known that they could have turned it into an amusement park. But I think it was really that first screening, like I said, the cast and crew screening, where I think all of us were surprised at what a great job Phil had done putting it together and how it had so much more power as a completed picture than it did even as a brilliant script.
Considering what you had been through personally, what was it difficult? I don't think people realize how many times you have to shoot a scene to get it right, and especially you're working with what you call golden time, that time when the sun is setting just so, and the continuity must be a nightmare to get everything to match up. You had to do it over and over and over, I imagine. Was that difficult, or you were able to compartmentalize as an actor, this is what I have to do?
Well, I mean, it's a little bit of both. I had worked very hard, as I talk about in the book, of learning to express my emotions. And, as an actor, part of expressing them is, kind of controlling them and having them when you need them and being able to to, you know, like in plays, you do 8 shows a week. You have to, if it's a heavily emotional show, that's a real taxing regimen that you put yourself through. And that was, I think, probably the most difficult thing about it was we could only shoot for about 15 minutes each night. So that 5-minute scene, we did pieces of that every night for 2 weeks while I was there in Iowa. And, you know, you sort of have to match what you happened the night before. And, you know, if you think about it, it's a little bit daunting to think that, you know, you sort of have to keep this very tense but sweet emotional tone, you know, every night right around sunset. You've got to, you know, kind of shoot the scene again and, you know, be Kevin's point of view one night and then turn the camera around and shoot on me the next night. And I think with some good editing, it actually looks like it all happened, you know, on one beautiful night.
During the introduction, where Kevin Costner introduces you to Annie and Karen, does John know that he's Ray's father at that point?
Well, in the introduction, I mean, it's just photos of me. When he first comes over to me, I mean, in my understanding, the way I played it was that I knew he was my son, and he knew I was his father.
Oh, he definitely knew you were his father, but I was just wondering if that... Because there are looks that you give each other that are more than just, you know, hi, how you doing?
Right. Well, what I loved about that script, and I talk about this in the book as well, is there's a certain... Like, for instance, when Archie Graham comes over to help out little Karen when she swallows the hot dog, he stops there at the edge of the field. Like everybody knows, you know, all the players and Ray and everybody knows that something's going to change if he steps over that imaginary line there. In the same way that early on when Shoeless Joe first appears at the field, he walks to the edge of the thing and Annie invites him in and he says, I don't think I can.
Right.
There's a vague understanding that something magical could be, you know, is happening and that could be violated by overstepping these unspoken rules. And I love that sort of mystic feeling about it. And so, you know, it was my intention that John knew that Ray was his son, but he knew that if he said it out loud, it would be, you know, it would somehow, you know, maybe it would make the field disappear. Maybe it would, you know, that the consequences weren't known, but, you know, were understood. In fact, when we shot the movie, at the end, you know, Ray says, hey, Dad, want to have a catch.
Right.
But when we shot it, there was no dad in there. It was just, hey, want to have a catch. So it was never said out loud. And in some of the audience screenings that they did just before the movie's release, there seemed to be some confusion. They were all wondering, well, why doesn't Ray Kinsella tell his dad that he's his son, you know? And they thought that it was kind of mean-spirited of him not to tell him, you know? And from my understanding, it was, you know, it was obvious, but, you know, that's because I was playing the part as opposed to, you know, trying to fit it together as an audience member. So anyway, they went back into the soundstage and had Kevin add the word dad in there just so that there was no confusion about that. And, you know, I think that's great because I think it would have been a shame if people had never figured out that that I was Ray's dad.
Well, certainly. I mean, the inclusion of that one word makes such a difference. And
Well, I'm just going to say, and that's usually the word where, you know, a lot of people just start crying,
right.
You know, because, yeah.
I'm wondering if he says that, I'm just reading into it or listening into it, there's a catch in his voice when he says that.
Right. Yeah, that part of it was really interesting. I mean, I think, if I remember right, we shot my side of that interaction first. And so when Kevin was saying those lines, I sort of cracked a little when I said, I'd like that. And so when we got around to shooting Kevin's side of it, you know, he got a catch in his throat when he was saying his line. And so it's interesting how that how that performance built, I think, you know, benefiting perhaps from the fact that we had to shoot it, you know, a little, you know, 15-second increment at a time over a couple of weeks. So
many people, when they're young, before they have families of their own, they say, I'm not going to raise my kids like my parents raised me. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do the other thing. You're a father now. What did you take away from the experience with your father? Did you feel like that? Or were there things that you realized when you became a father that made you think, you know, he didn't do such a terrible job?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think for any of us, it's there's both aspects of it. And I think the older you get in general, the more you appreciate what your parents did for you. You know, when you're young, you think that they're just trying to hold you back and keep you from doing what you want to do. Or, you know, when in fact, you know, when you have your own children, that in general, you're trying to protect them from making mistakes that you made yourself. Or, so, I mean, my father was a really great dad. But you know, what I didn't want in my life was I didn't want to have these kind of secrets and this kind of stoic lack of ability to express emotions. And so that's what I went out in search of when I wanted to, you know, be my own man. I became an actor so that I could, you know, better navigate those emotional things that my dad just, you know, wasn't that great at. And it wasn't until, you know, a couple of years before he died that I had a much better understanding of why he was the way he was, because of a secret he had kind of kept from us his whole life. And I discussed that in the book, and it kind of just made it all come, it all made sense to me suddenly. And I think that's the other thing that happens to us is, as we get older, we understand more about our parents as a person, as people, and the choices they made or the choices that were forced upon them. And so as we go through life and the dreams we have are altered by the circumstances, we just become a little more tolerant, I think, and generous in our appreciation of them.
I want to switch gears just a little bit to talk about the actual process of writing the book again. How did you try to get this book published?
Well, what was funny is when I decided to write a book, and then I decided that Field of Dreams was the thing that I could write about that, you know, maybe nobody else could write, certainly my point of view about it. I was thinking, oh, well, that's going to be cool because the 25th anniversary is going to be in 2.5 years. That'll give me plenty of time. And, you know, so I'm writing away, and, it's not exactly easy for me. It takes me 2.5 years sort of to get enough material and to try to start putting it in shape. And then I hadn't thought anything about how it was going to get published or any of that stuff. I just thought, well, first you have to write it, you know, and I was practical enough to do that.
They will print.
Well, that's unfortunately not true in this case. But I got closer to the, you know, publishing date, and suddenly, you know, I started checking online and find out how this works and talking to writers. And, you know, pretty much what I heard from everybody is, well, once you finish the book and you think you're done with it, and you can find a publisher, which is not so easy these days, you've got about a year before, even if you're lucky, it's ever going to, you know, actually be published. And because there's so much editing, and so here I was, you know, 4 months away from, you know, the 25th anniversary, and I'm finally learning that I need a whole other year in order to get it published. So anyway, I ended up kind of going into guerrilla mode, and I ended up contacting the guy named Lawrence Kesenick, who was a publisher, an editor at Houghton Mifflin Publishing, and he's the one that convinced Bill Kinsella to turn a little 25-page short story into Shoeless Joe, which then became Field of Dreams. And I just called him out of desperation, found him on the internet, and said, hey, I wrote this book, and, you know, nobody could do a better job editing it than you, since you kind of started this whole thing by getting Kinsella to write this book in the first place. And I was lucky enough that he agreed to take me on, and so we kind of compacted the year-long editing process into just a few months. And anyway, then we managed to get the book out for the 25th anniversary, which is fantastic. So
now you also did what's becoming more and more common. You went on the internet and you tried to raise money for this project. Talk a little bit about that.
Once I realized that I could finish it in time, then I began to realize, well, in order to publish it, if I'm doing this, kind of on my own, I've got to have enough money to actually print the books. And, contrary to what many people think about actors, many of us are, just kind of blue collar guys who are getting by. We're not all, wealthy with bank accounts. And so I started an Indiegogo campaign. And for your listeners who don't know, there's a couple crowdfunding, websites where if you have a project, you pitch that project online and people go there for the excitement of, paying you some whatever they can afford, towards your completion of that project, and you offer them in return some perks. And in my case, it was most people just gave me $25 for an autographed copy of the book, and we raised over $13,000 so that I could publish the book once I was finished, in order to be able to sell it, in order to get the money back to buy more books to sell them, and also to do an RV book tour. This summer we're going on the road and to minor league and major league baseball stadiums all over the country, selling the books. We're going to we just found out yesterday that we're going to Wrigley Field on May 20th and 21st, and we're going to be we've got something set up at Fenway Park in Boston in July, and we're going to the Kenosha Kingfish. That's a team in Kenosha, Wisconsin, for a book signing. I think that's June 2nd. And we're just keep piecing together all these great little ballparks, and we can do it all because people out there supported me. If any of you are listening, thank you so much. I've sent you your book if you haven't received it yet. It's kind of a great thing because it just helps when you think, wow, some people out there believe in me, and it kind of gives you that impetus to make dreams come true, like my writing this book.
Sure. If the people want more information, is there a website they can visit?
Yes, we've got all this. We've got some great stuff up. It's at DwyerBrown.com, which is D-W-I-E-R, Brown like the color .com. And there's been some crazy stuff happening. Kevin Costner's got a copy of the book. I have a picture with him. I did shots with him backstage at a Chicago club where he was playing a musical gig. He has a band called Modern West. And so on the actual anniversary of the release of the movie, 25th anniversary, we did some shots of tequila backstage in the suburbs of Chicago. And, we'll see each other again on Father's Day. There's a big event at the Field of Dreams in Dyersville. And it's going to be huge. Bob Costas is going to be there, and Matt Lauer is going to put some stuff on the Today Show. Timothy Busfield's coming back, and there's going to be a celebrity baseball game. And a lot of it's free to the public, and they're going to show the movie on the Field of Dreams on Friday night, the 13th of June. So there's going to be a lot of fun stuff.
It does sound like a lot of fun. And we've been talking with Dwyer Brown, author of the new book, If You Build It, a book about fathers, fate, and Field of Dreams. Dwyer, thank you very much.
Hey, thank you, Ron.
And that'll do it for another podcast edition of the Baseball Bookshelf. I really wanted to get this one out early. So you could get Dwyer's book for Father's Day, for yourself, for dad, for grandpa, for anybody with a father. It makes a great book. And if I ever am lucky enough to do another version of 501 Baseball Books Fans Must Read Before They Die, I'm sure that will be including If You Build It, a book about fathers, fate, and Field of Dreams. Our next guest will be Chris Donnelly, author of How the Yankees Explain New York. And remember to visit Ron Kaplan's BaseballBookshelf.com for the latest news on baseball books, movies, music, pop culture. Pretty much the slogan by now. And don't forget our Book of the Week contest. Leave a comment and you may just get a new book. Well, thanks everybody. Take care. See you next time. Cover this land. Gee, it's a